Welcome to the Unconventional Dyad Podcast, where psychology and psychoanalysis meet social justice, feminism, politics, climate change, critical theory, graduate student mental health, and the arts.
Your hosts are Carly and Laura, two graduate students and friends committed to bridging the gap between the field of psychology, social issues, and society.
Thank you for joining us. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Unconventional Dyad Podcast. We're finally back with a new episode for you all, and we really think you're going to enjoy this one. On this episode, Laura speaks with Dr. Nafisa Ismail, an associate professor at the School of Psychology at the University of Ottawa and the holder of a university research chair in stress and mental health. Today's topics of discussion include stress-induced mental illnesses, the gut-brain axis and its role in mental health, the effects of stressors on puberty and adolescent mental health, how probiotic consumption during puberty might protect against depression and anxiety, the physiological and neurological effects of the COVID-19 virus and the pandemic on children and teens, sex differences in mental health, open science and the power of collaboration, and integrating the body into the study of the mind. We really hope you enjoy this episode. Dr. Ismail, welcome to the Unconventional Dyad Podcast.
Hi, Laura.
Hello, thank you so much for being here. Would you mind just letting our listeners know who you are, what you do, any of your personal or professional identities?
Absolutely. My name is Nafisa Ismail. I'm an associate professor at the School of Psychology at the Faculty of Social Sciences at the University of Ottawa. And my research focuses on the impacts of stress during puberty and how that may change the brain and predispose to mental illnesses. I'm also the holder of a university research chair in stress and mental health.
Great. That sounds great. I'm wondering how you got interested in the research that you're doing.
Yeah, good question. It all began for me when I was a postdoctoral fellow at UMass Amherst. My supervisor at that time was an expert in female sexual behavior and how hormones impact the maturation of the reproductive system and so on. And so I went to his lab actually interested in studying female sexual behavior. And at that time, it so happened that we made this discovery that stress during puberty is impacting not only reproductive behavior, but also a number of non-reproductive behaviors. And it was also a period during which the U.S. government stopped funding sex behavior research. So we were kind of forced into directing our research towards the non-reproductive behaviors, which actually led us on this really cool path. I, as an independent researcher, continued the work that I had begun as a postdoctoral fellow. And I pursued this research that showed that stress during critical periods of development can change the brain and predispose to certain mental illnesses. Because the reality is that throughout our lifespan, we go through multiple critical periods of development. There are three main ones. There is the prenatal period, then there is the perinatal period, which is right after birth, and the pubertal period. And a lot of research has been done examining the impacts of stress. And when I say stress, I'm using it in a very loose manner here, where I'm also referring to immune challenges. So I would say factors that are going to activate both the HPA axis, our stress axis, and our immune system. And there's been a lot of work examining the impact of such stressors during the prenatal period and also during the perinatal period. But little is known about what these stressors do during the pubertal period. And we also know from epidemiological findings that puberty is the period where a lot of stress-related mental illnesses tend to begin. So depression and anxiety tend to start during this period. In fact, depression has a mean age of onset of 14 years of age. And so it starts quite young, and we don't realize that. And often when it is present during puberty, early adolescence, it goes undetected. We associate these behavioral changes that we're seeing in children usually to just hormonal changes, to them going through puberty and so on. And so we don't really seek out a real diagnosis for it. But in cases where we do seek out a diagnosis, we see that often these cases tend to be treatment resistant. So although we want to try to help and we try to help, we're not being effective in our help. So this is why in my lab I became really interested in understanding, well, what are these stressors, you know, that can increase our vulnerability to mental illnesses, to these stress-induced mental illnesses? We also know that girls tend to be 2 times more likely to develop some of these disorders like depression than boys. So I'm also interested in understanding this sex difference as well. And also trying to see if there is anything we can do to prevent stress-induced mental illnesses. Because seeing that the treatment side has not necessarily been effective with that age group, I am wondering if there is anything we can do to prevent it in the first place, you know? So that's where my research is focusing on. That's where we're going with all the work that we've been doing and that we are continuing to do.
That's such important research, yeah. I'm also wondering how the COVID-19 pandemic might factor into this conversation. More specifically, I was wondering how the pandemic and the virus itself might impact children and teenagers on a physiological level, on a neurological level, mental health-wise.
Yeah, that is an excellent, excellent question. It's true that the pandemic turns out to be exactly that kind of stressor that will impact both our stress response and also our immune response. For various reasons, because the COVID-19 pandemic has stressors associated with the pandemic and the regulatory measures that are in place. Those are causing a lot of stress to our adolescents, to the children in the society. We see that they're having to adapt to these changing rules all the time, and they need to maintain this flexibility that may not be as easy for them. And so that causes a lot of stress, and these stresses that last for a long period of time are perfect examples of stressors that are going to activate both the stress response and the immune response. And so just these regulatory measures that are in place are perfect examples of this kind of stressors that can alter brain organization, neurochemistry within the brain, and perhaps even then lead to the predisposition to certain stress-related mental illnesses. Now, there is also the virus itself, so getting infected with the virus that we know is going to activate the immune system. In fact, it activates both the innate and adaptive immune system. And my research shows that when this occurs during specific periods during the lifespan, that it can have enduring consequences. Even if we get the virus, even if we recover from it and we're back to normal, our body's back to homeostasis, we see that these short-lasting exposure to inflammation are sufficient to cause long-lasting changes in the brain that will forever increase our vulnerability to these stress-related mental illnesses, unfortunately.
That's pretty scary, and that's something that I think I was noticing just in my clinical work. So I don't work with children or teenagers anymore, but I used to. And even with adults, I've noticed, you know, a lot of changes, especially in terms of long-term COVID symptoms.
Absolutely, absolutely. So long-term COVID is in itself another illness that we need to investigate further. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing that about 10% of the population that is getting infected with COVID-19 ends up suffering from long COVID. We also see that women seem to be more susceptible to long COVID than men. So there's a lot of work left to be done there too. Mm-hmm. I just want to point out that when I say, you know, stress and how stress is impacting the body and our brain, it's important that we keep in mind too, especially in the context of the pandemic, that we are each, as individuals, living the pandemic differently. Mm-hmm. We're exposed to varying levels of stressors. Some of us may not find it as stressful as others, and that is totally fine. It really depends on how we are experiencing personally the pandemic. And we see that if we are able to develop some resilience to stressors like the current pandemic, that there is a possibility of minimizing its impact on our brain and our vulnerability to develop mental illness.
Yeah, that's definitely very hopeful. One way that I've heard people describe the pandemic is that we're all in different boats, but in the same storm. It's just that maybe our boats are equipped differently. So I like that you pointed that out.
Yeah, that's a really nice analogy. Yes, that's exactly it.
Mm-hmm. And it's hopeful that it seems like there are things we can do to address this issue, because I did used to work with teenagers, high school students. I was a school counselor. And when COVID first started, I moved to virtual, you know, support groups and virtual therapy that I was providing for schools. And just the amount of turmoil that the students were going through because of the pandemic, because they had family members who got the virus, it was just really heartbreaking. So it's nice to know that people are looking into this issue. I'm wondering, so we talked about COVID as a stressor. What other kinds of stressors do you investigate in your research?
Yeah. So other stressors that we investigate are stressors that perhaps we can refer to as psychosocial stressors. So in humans, that would be, for example, bullying, intimidation, abuse, this kind of stressors. We, of course, work with an animal model, with a mouse model. So our example of such a stressor is lipopolysaccharide, which is a bacterial endotoxin that is isolated from the cell wall of the E. coli bacteria. And exposure to this bacterial endotoxin activates both the stress system along with the immune system. So it gives us the ability to be able to mimic what happens in humans, but from a mouse perspective, you know. And this bacterial endotoxin is going to activate the stress and the immune system for about 48 hours. And then the animals recover and they look just fine. But the females, they show increased depression-like behavior when we test them in adulthood. And the males show increased anxiety-like behavior when we test them in adulthood. Other stressors that we've tried are also viral mimetics. We have also tried factors that are not specifically related to the immune system, like chronic sleep disruption, because that we know is a very common stressor in adolescents. It's a change, natural change in the circadian rhythm of adolescent, where we see that they have a harder time falling asleep earlier, so they go to bed later and later and later, but then they have to still wake up nevertheless early the next morning to go to school. And so there is this reduced sleep time that is accumulating over days, over weeks, over months, and that we see causes inflammation within the body. So it's not only activating the stress system, but also the immune system. And in our mice, we are also seeing increased depression-like behavior in males and in females following chronic sleep disruption.
This is kind of a question that I'm throwing at you now, but I'm wondering if you have any hypotheses about those sex differences that you mentioned.
Yes, very good question. You know, whenever we are studying sex differences, we always go to hormones. Hormones are always the first suspect, you know. But in this case, we did go to hormones, and we can tell you with assurance that the hormones do not completely account for the sex differences. So there are other things here that are causing this sex difference. One of the factors that we have been interested in investigating is the gut microbiota and how the bacteria within the gut may be responsible then for this sex difference that we're seeing.
That's actually a perfect transition into my next question. So you have studied the gut-brain axis and its role in mental health. This is one of the ways that I actually came across your work as I was looking into my own research on this. Tell us a little bit about what the gut-brain axis is, and if you don't mind, describe some of your findings.
Absolutely. The gut-brain axis is essentially a bi-directional communication between the gut and the brain. So the bacteria in the gut are able to influence the brain and its functioning, and vice versa, the brain is able to in some ways direct the type of bacteria that are going to colonize the gut and how they are going to function. So a lot of people refer to the gut as sort of our second brain, you know, but these bacteria in our gut, they live in complete symbiosis with all the other systems that are present in our body. And they're extremely important in regulating all these systems, including the immune system and our stress system. And what we are seeing with my research is that the bacteria in the gut are involved in stress-induced mental illnesses. In fact, they seem to be the mediators of stress-induced mental illnesses. And what we see seems to be happening is that it's a story of a leaky gut leading to a leaky blood-brain barrier. And that's what the problem is. So when we are exposed to a stressor like that, that is going to not only activate our stress response, but also cause inflammation within our body, that inflammation is also present within the gut. And it makes the lining of the gut leakier, allowing for these inflammatory toxins to leave the gut and enter the periphery. Where normally, if our gut lining was not compromised, then these toxins would remain within the gut and then eventually be eliminated out of the body. But because they leak out and they enter now the periphery, the body, now they are impacting also the blood-brain barrier and making the blood-brain barrier leakier. So the blood-brain barrier is this barrier that we have that protects our brain from the rest of the toxins that are present in our body. But if we increase its permeability, then we allow the toxins from our body to enter the brain. And that causes neuroinflammation then in the brain, which when it occurs during critical periods of development, periods during which the brain is being naturally reorganized, remodeled, we see that this neuroinflammation is actually interfering with the natural reorganizing and remodeling. And that's what could be leading then to mental illnesses later on. Now, we are seeing that stressors are affecting the gut of males and females differently. So males and females naturally and normally have different bacteria within the gut. They vary in concentration between males and females. And so when stressors arrive, the gut of a male versus the gut of the female is going to be impacted differently. And we feel that perhaps that is a mechanism that could explain the sex difference that we're seeing later on in mental illnesses.
That makes a lot of sense. What kinds of mental illnesses have been linked to this leaky gut issue?
Yeah, so depression and anxiety have definitely been linked to the gut and issues and dysbiosis within the gut. But there is also neurodevelopmental disorders like autism that have also been linked to dysbiosis within the gut. And there's been a lot of work trying to see if there's anything we can do at the level of the gut to prevent these disorders, knowing that there is this link. And this is why some of our work has included probiotics, because we've been wanting to make the gut more resilient at the time that the stress is arriving, so that perhaps we can mitigate these impacts of stress.
Yeah, definitely. I found an article by you. I think you published a paper in 2019 about how probiotic consumption during puberty can protect against depression and anxiety. Would you mind just talking to us about that paper?
I would be very happy to do so. We're so proud of this research. We came from the idea that if the bacteria in the gut can increase our vulnerability to mental disorders, then they can probably also decrease it if we colonize the gut with the right bacteria. So at that time, when we started this research, there was already a lot of work that was ongoing looking at the impacts of probiotics on autism, but not much was done looking at other disorders, at like mood-related disorders. So we partnered with a small company. It was a family-owned company located in Quebec, Canada. Their name is Leo San, and their company was producing these probiotic products that were readily available in health stores. And what we liked about their products is that, unlike other companies, their products were very well detailed in terms of what sort of bacteria was present at which concentration and so on. And we were looking for a product that we could administer to our mice that would have good ecological validity, in that humans could also easily access this product. So we used this product, prepared it exactly the same way that it would be prepared for human consumption, but we administered it at a dose appropriate for our mice. And indeed, what we found is that simply a two-week course of this probiotic treatment — our probiotic was kefir, so it had a cocktail of probiotic bacteria in it, and we gave it just for 2 weeks, starting 1 week before we administered our stressor and continuing 1 week after the stressor exposure, and that was it. Then we ended it. We let the mice age, and when they reached adulthood, we saw that the mice that hadn't received the kefir, the females were displaying more depression-like behavior, and the males were displaying more anxiety-like behavior. But the mice that got the kefir treatment did not show any of these behaviors. They were continuing to behave very normally. In fact, they were not at all different from their control non-stressed mice. So, you know, this work was really exciting for us, because we felt that we were maybe now making a step closer towards understanding how the bacteria in our gut can actually help us prevent stress-induced mental illnesses. Now, we still have a lot of work to do in this area, because, as I mentioned, we used kefir. So kefir is a cocktail of probiotic bacteria. Now we really want to be able to identify the most important bacteria that are important in building this resilience against stressors and protecting the brain long term. We also want to understand what these probiotics are doing to the lining of the gut, to the blood-brain barrier. Is it increasing their resilience, making them less permeable? That's what we're thinking and hypothesizing, and we're doing work right now to test these hypotheses. But this is the direction that we're going. And if this works, if indeed the probiotics are able to help us, eventually, what we would like to be able to do is recommend that perhaps during certain critical periods of development that parents think of giving their kids probiotics. They have no side effects, you know, and if it can help why not, right? But we're not at this stage yet. There is still a lot of work to be done before we get there. But we're really hopeful that eventually we'll be able to develop some sort of a preventative measure.
That's really, really exciting. I have younger sisters who are in their teenage years, and so I can imagine how impactful this research could possibly be. I do want to come back to asking you about the impacts of this research and maybe some of the implications. Mm. But I also want to ask, I'm just curious, you know, what causes gut issues in the first place?
Yeah, so stress definitely impacts the gut, but there are other factors too, like antibiotics are going to change the bacteria in your gut. So, you know, when we are ill, sometimes there is no other option but to take antibiotics. And antibiotics, depending on how strong they are, they can eventually even wipe out completely the bacteria in your gut for a short period of time. But what my work is showing is that sometimes even short periods of changes in bacteria within the gut are sufficient to cause long-lasting changes in the brain. So antibiotics are one. We also see that other factors, you know, like chronic stress are going to impact the bacteria within the gut. And I think it's also important that we make a distinction here because it's not all stressors that are bad. Some stressors are good. When we say bad stressors, we are referring to stressors that are long-lasting, stressors that we have no control over, and that are essentially wearing us down. But good stressors are stressors like deadlines, exams, like those are stressors that motivate us, that help us concentrate, achieve what we need to achieve, but then once we get to the deadline, they're over. So stressors that have a deadline, they're actually good for us, you know, but it's those other stressors that are out of our control, like the pandemic, which doesn't seem to have a deadline, are stressors that can have negative impacts on our body. So these stressors are going to definitely impact our gut.
That makes a lot of sense. That makes me think too and wonder about trauma and how trauma might be related to the gut-brain axis. And I'm wondering if you've looked into any of that at all.
We haven't yet, but definitely trauma is linked to that because trauma is a form of chronic stress.
Right.
It's often a stressor that we're not able to escape or evade. And sometimes even when that traumatic period has ended, we see that we're not able to fully recover from it, you know, like
right.
We're left with thoughts, we are left with changes in our brain, changes in our body that are really long lasting. And so definitely trauma is an example of the type of stress that will not only activate our stress response, but also our immune system, cause inflammation and so on.
Definitely. Yeah. Thank you for speaking on that. I am wondering if we can go back to this idea of potential implications of your research, because I'm really curious, and I'm thinking that probably some of our listeners are curious too about what this might mean for, you know, parents who are raising children or for mental health clinicians working with people across the lifespan or pediatricians. You know, what are some potential implications? You mentioned the probiotic use. Maybe parents might want to have their children take probiotics during puberty. Are there other implications that you can comment on?
Yeah, if we do really find that there is a direct link between the bacteria within our gut and mental illness, then maybe at some point we will get to the level where we will be able to profile individuals based on the bacteria that we find within their gut and maybe identify those that may be more vulnerable to developing certain disorders later on and perhaps developing preventative programs where we could include these individuals. It may help us also, depending on the profile of the gut, be able to maybe predict the effectiveness of certain treatments, mental illness treatments, so like certain antidepressants, and be able to, you know, right away prescribe the one that would be most effective for that particular individual based on their gut profile. So there is definitely a lot of implications for this work. It's just a lot of work, and there is still a lot to be done because at the moment I'm working with a mouse model, and while we are finding links between the bacteria in the gut of the mouse and its behavior, we do know that the bacteria in the gut of a mouse are very different from the bacteria that we find in the gut of a human. There is also then important differences between the bacteria that we find in the gut of men and women. So we need to tease those differences apart. And then there is also the fact that diet is also impacting our gut. So depending on which type of diet we follow, we're going to have a different gut profile. And also it depends on which geographical region we're from, because there are also a lot of cultural differences in gut profiles. So there is just so much work to be done to understand, you know, first these differences and how they may relate to differences in behavior, differences in the brain, and then what does it all mean in terms of illness. So first we need to understand better the normal gut and how it impacts all these various systems, and then move to the ill gut and then be able to see what its implications are. But if we make enough progress, definitely there is a lot of implication for this work. And one thing that we've moved towards now that will hopefully help quicker progress is that all the researchers that are working on the gut microbiome are now openly sharing their data, the sequences that they are finding within the guts of the subjects that they're working with. So, you know, eventually we can put all this data together, and that's what we need. We need to be able to profile as many animals, as many humans as we can, and share that together so that we can make greater progress.
That's wonderful. Do you know what led to that open sharing of data?
Yes, it came from the fact that, you know, there are so many different ways of analyzing the gut. And depending on the technique you end up using, you end up finding very different gut profiles. So there's been this push towards standardized procedures, and that has been a global push. Mm. So researchers around the world are trying to find the best, effective, cost-efficient, because that's the other problem, is that it's so costly to do this kind of research, but a cost-efficient way, reliable way that all researchers could use in a homogeneous manner, so that we can then yield the data that will be comparable, that we will be able to draw links from. Mm-hmm. And so that's what pushed this idea of sharing the data.
That's really great. I just ask because I know in a lot of scientific fields, unfortunately, that's not the norm to share that data. So it's really
great. That's
very
true. Yeah, no, that's very true. But I think more and more now, especially since the pandemic, researchers are realizing that if we want to make great progress and if we want to speed up the progress that we're making, we need to collaborate, we need to share. So we're starting to see now this movement towards open science. Mm-hmm. So hopefully this maintains, but it's really a movement that I would say truly began once the pandemic arrived.
Mm. Interesting. Yeah. So where is your research taking you next?
So we want to continue investigating these sex differences. We want to now get into the mechanisms, though, and try to see how these stressors that we are giving externally are changing the way the brain is functioning. So one of the studies we're working on right now is looking at how brain metabolism is changed following chronic sleep disruption. So does the brain utilize energy differently? And if it does, how is it changed? How is it different for males and females? So that's a study that is currently ongoing. We are also very much interested in examining other stressors. So we've done some work looking at exposure to oral contraceptives during puberty and adolescence, because we know that that is also a factor that is going to alter completely the neuroendocrine system. And when it is occurring during a critical period of development, we have shown that it leads to structural and functional changes in the brain. So we want to pursue that further, understand the mechanism of it more. The idea is not at all to be able to then say, take oral contraceptives, don't take oral contraceptives. But we really want to just share information so that everyone can make an informed decision when they are planning to begin oral contraceptives during a critical period of development.
Definitely. That's so interesting that you mentioned that, because that was something else I was looking into that I got interested in recently is the impact of hormonal birth control on the brain. And I was reading that, like you said, it actually has structural differences. It causes functional changes. I was reading a study where women's personality characteristics were slightly different on and off of hormonal birth control, and the types of partners that they were choosing were slightly different.
Absolutely, absolutely. It also changes resting state functional connectivity. So when our brain is simply at rest, we see that there is constant neuronal firing occurring, and it's part of neuroplasticity and what supports learning and so on. But we see that when we are under hormonal contraceptives, especially during puberty, also, the neuronal firing during a resting state is altered. And often that has been linked to an increased vulnerability to depression. So it is possible, too, that there is a link between starting oral contraceptives early on during puberty and early adolescence and maybe developing mood disorders later on.
That's super interesting. I'm just so excited by the work that you do, because it really taps into the connection between mind-body, which I think, unfortunately, in a lot of fields is missing. That's just really exciting.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, for us, it's been really important that we integrate the body in our study of the brain. You are right that for the longest time, the focus has been solely on the brain when it comes to neuroscience. And we've studied the brain as though it was sort of an isolated organ. And we did think that it was an isolated organ because of the blood-brain barrier that was protecting it from the rest of the body. But in the last 10 years or 15 years or so, we do see that there is this increasing interest now to study how the brain interacts with various other organs within the body, such as the brain-heart connection, the brain-gut connection, and so on. And then there is, of course, also the connection between the brain and the reproductive organs and so on. So it's become now increasingly important to study the brain in connection with other parts of our body as well.
Yeah, and you made a point earlier too about, I mean, it just seems like everything's kind of interconnected, right? Like you mentioned, geography impacts your gut, your culture impacts your gut, your diet, your other organs, reproductive functioning, all of these things impact everything else within you. It's just so interesting how interconnected it is.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's truly a big mystery that really needs deep investigation.
Definitely. Yeah, so I'm wondering if you can share some of your maybe hopes for the future, whether those are professional hopes or just general hopes for the world.
Absolutely. I'm hopeful that we will have more researchers interested in investigating the gut-brain axis and how the bacteria in the gut are related to so many other disorders, because now there is evidence coming forward connecting the bacteria in the gut to neurodegenerative disorders as well, such as Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease. So I'm hopeful that we can have more research in those areas as well, because when it comes to Alzheimer's disease, again, it's a situation where we don't have any effective treatments. We really need to, and it's a present issue now with the aging population. So perhaps, you know, investigating how the bacteria in the gut can help develop potential treatments that may be helpful, or maybe even identifying which individuals are going to be more susceptible to developing neurodegenerative disorders will be helpful. I'm also hopeful that we will continue these investigations looking at the brain in connection with other organs within our body. Because really studying the brain, we've done it a lot. We've done it over the past 100 years. And if we now want to make greater progress, we need to move beyond the brain and connect it to the other organs. And sex difference. I'm hopeful that everyone will investigate further sex differences in their work. It's clear now from all the evidence that we have in the literature that the male body and the female body are completely different, and that we cannot take information that we have from one and generalize it to the other. So I'm hopeful that everyone will start investigating sex differences, you know, and not shy away from it. You know, there are a lot of researchers that find it intimidating to incorporate sex difference research, but there is a lot of papers out there now that are available to guide researchers in how to properly carry out these sex difference research so that they don't become too costly, they don't require too many resources. So let's not shy away from it and try to integrate it in our work.
That's great. Yeah, I was going to say that. I think a lot of people are intimidated by that, or they're not sure how to approach it, or they feel like maybe they might be doing something controversial by highlighting sex differences. But they are very real and they impact our functioning in life.
They do. Absolutely.
Yeah, great. I was also struck by when you were talking just how much your work, I think, could do to destigmatize mental illness. Like, there's so much stigma around mental illness, even today, even though it's improved quite a lot. But just to be able to point to certain things like, look, there's all these things going on in the body that might impact a mental illness or the presentation of symptoms. And I think that could be really powerful, too, in terms of destigmatizing.
Absolutely, absolutely. Mental illnesses are often a consequence of interactions between our environment and what is happening inside our body. So it's essentially this interaction that determines in certain individuals whether the vulnerability or the susceptibility to develop some of these illnesses is going to be increased or not. Sometimes we live in environments where we don't really have control over all the factors that we're exposed to. And sometimes we do. So when we do, then, okay, great, we can try to control these factors and try to build our resilience. But sometimes we don't have the opportunity to do that, and we cannot build our resilience. And there should never be stigma around mental illness, because it's just like any other health illness, you know, it's part of our body, it's normal. And just like we don't have stigma over some physical illness, we should also not have stigma over mental illness.
I completely agree. Dr. Ismail, we're almost at the end of our conversation, but I'm wondering if you could share maybe something that you learned this past year, whether that's professionally, personally, related to the COVID pandemic or not, but one lesson that you learned this year and how this lesson has impacted you.
Absolutely. I've learned so many lessons in this past year. So many things have happened for me. Personally, professionally, just like for everyone else, you know, and some of the lessons that I've learned, they're both on the personal and professional plan. One thing that I've come to realize is that there is nothing more important than family. I think that a lot of the time before the pandemic, we were taking these family times as granted. And now that they became more limited during the pandemic, we have learned to appreciate this time and not to take them for granted, because the people we love are not always going to be around us forever. So it's important that we try to maximize the time that we have with them. Professionally, I would say the pandemic has taught me that actually a lot of my work can be done remotely, which I didn't realize before. So I was always on site before. I was always on campus. I never used to work from home. As a professor, I always felt like I had to be on site. And then when we were forced to be at home, I came to realize that actually a lot of my work can be done remotely. Yes, not all of it, but some of it. And the portion that can be done from home can actually be done more productively when it's done from home. So I think going forward, I want, because for me it's really important to maintain good productivity and to always be able to support my students as much as I can, that I will try to tease apart these tasks and maximize my productivity for the tasks that have to be done on site versus those that can be done remotely.
Definitely. I'm wondering if you have any final thoughts that you'd like to share with our audience, and if you could also share ways that people can get in touch with you or learn more about your work.
Yes, one take-home message that I would tell my listeners to is don't be afraid of stressors. Just know to identify the stressors that are good for you versus those that are bad for you. In situations where you find that you are faced with a factor that is causing you a lot of stress that you're not able to control, try to see if you're able to develop certain strategies that can help you bring your stress level down. And so that requires getting to know yourself a little bit more and try to see what works for you in terms of relaxation, in terms of being able to build some resilience, because if we're able to bring down those cortisol level, that stress hormone, we will be able to then build resilience. So that would be one take-home message for the listeners. And if anyone would like to get in touch with me, I'm active on Twitter and on LinkedIn, so you can find me there. If you are interested in just occasionally peeking into the progress that we're doing in the lab, you can also take a look at our lab website. You'll get to see all the members from our team, as well as the newest publications that are coming out of our work.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Ismail. I really appreciate your time and your wisdom and all that you've taught us.
Thank you so much, Laura. It was a pleasure.